Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 505, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates, being recorded on April 3rd of the year 2005. We're going to plunge right in here. This, as the name implies, as the title implies, is an update of a number of different stories, or in some cases, an introduction of a new story that has not been covered before. And we're going to plunge right in. And research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience. In the past, I've done a long series about German corporate control over the American media, and that focuses largely on Bertelsmann, one of the largest media corporations in the world. It was the SS publishing house in World War II, and there's every suggestion that it is a key element of what I call the Underground Reich. Some people have said, well, you know, World War II was a long time ago. Well, Bertelsmann's house historian, a guy named Dirk Bobendom, published a book as recently as 1998 blaming World War II on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, U.S. imperialism, and Jewish control over the banking industry and U.S. media. That was just in 1998. This also is against the background of the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk, published by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the most virulent of the and most important of the domestic Nazi groups. That book and the companion volume, The Turner Diaries, are not, in my considered opinion, mere novels, but are actually manifestos, blueprints for what the Nazi movement is doing. And indeed, the late William Pierce, the head of the National Alliance, was quite explicit about the purposes of his books, namely as teaching tools, as manifestos. So my assessment is not all that far-reaching. In Serpent's Walk, basically the SS and the Third Reich go underground, build up their economic muscle, buy into the American opinion-forming media, and then after a series of devastating terrorist incidents which ruin the United States involving weapons of mass destruction, they martial law is declared, and they take over. I would note that Bertelsmann has more than twice the volume of any other English-language publisher, and when the house historian for the SS publishing house as recently as 98 publishes a book blaming World War II on Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Jewish control of the news media, you're in trouble, folks. So it is in that context with the SS publisher, and there's every indication that Bertelsmann is an underground Reich principality, we should digest the following. This is a Reuters story headlined, Intel and Bertelsmann to develop technology. Subtitle, the products will be used to download and share music, films, and games online. Reads in part, chipmaker Intel Corporation and media conglomerate Bertelsmann plan to cooperate in developing technology for downloading and sharing film clips and games from the Internet. Intel will make chips for PCs, notebooks, and mobile phones that are compatible with a new online media file-sharing platform from Bertelsmann's services and technology arm, Arvato, capitalizing on growing public appetite for accessing music and other media online. So the SS publisher will be moving into your PCs and cell phones, which should be delightful to contemplate. Another story about BMG, about Bertelsmann, and that is that they have moved up in the music world. Their music arm, BMG, has merged with Sony to become one of the largest media music companies in the world. This is from the BBC News, Indies Challenge Sony-BMG Merger. It reads in part, independent music companies are launching a legal challenge to the European Union's decision to allow the merger of Sony and Bertelsmann BMG. Impala, the body representing 2,500 indie labels, is appealing to prevent what it calls a market imbalance, unquote. Permission for them to merge meant that 80% of the world's music is owned by just four record companies. And one of those is Bertelsmann, or its music arm BMG, which is now merged with Sony. Okay, so updating the German corporate control over the American news media. And again, I refer interested listeners to the many broadcasts that I've done about German corporate control over the American media. And basically, Bertelsmann gives every indication of being the SS publishing house that it once was. It's just that it's moved into different media. In a number of broadcasts, we've taken a look at the AMIA bombing in Buenos Aires, Argentina in 1994. We've also taken a look at a number of articles about the corruption that took place in Argentina under Carlos Menem. Carlos Menem, like Manzer El Kassar, like his ex-wife, and a number of other principals in Argentine intelligence, were all Syrian, not only of Syrian extraction, but all from the same tiny town in Syria, Brood, Syria. Which is very interesting in and of itself. How do you get a whole bunch of people moving from Syria to Argentina and then moving up to be basically the Argentine government and power elite? One of the things that we've spoken about in connection with the AMIA bombing is that it appears to have involved collaboration between Latin American Hezbollah elements and elements of Sunni terrorism that ultimately coalesced into Al-Qaeda. Specifically, we took a look at that in For the Record program number 457. And in that broadcast as well, we took a look at the fact that an FBI investigation into the AMIA bombing revealed that some of the Argentine policemen implicated in that crime were members of an organization called White Aryan Resistance. That is an American white supremacist group founded by Tom Metzger. Some members of White Aryan Resistance are alleged to have included the late Timothy McVeigh, as well as Dennis Mahone, a key American neo-Nazi and white supremacist leader. So the allegation, or the discovery, I should say, by the FBI, that Argentine policemen who had participated at the operational level in the AMIA bombing in 1994, that, by the way, was the bombing of a Jewish cultural center in Argentina that not incidentally housed records of Nazi, basically the flight of Nazi war criminals, the discovery that those Argentine policemen who had been collaborating with Islamist terrorists to bomb a Jewish cultural center in Argentina, that these guys were members of an American-based white supremacist group is more than a little interesting. We've taken a look in a number of broadcasts about evidentiary tributaries connecting Menem's milieu with the milieu of September 11th and Al-Qaeda. What we're going to do now is to take a look at an allegation that Carlos Menem's presidency was actually financed by the BCCI and people involved in it. BCCI was a Pakistani-based bank, largely capitalized by Saudis. It basically was an intelligence front for arms trafficking, drug trafficking, and the financing of terrorism. The BCCI machinations took place through the Clearstream Network, which later was the vehicle for many of the machinations that funded Al-Taqwa and, through Bank Al-Taqwa, Al-Qaeda as well. The following article was researched for us by Lucy Commissar, whose work has graced our airwaves for some time. We'll be hearing again from Lucy in the not-too-distant future. Lucy got this story from the Euromoney.com website. The author is Jules Evans. It's dateline January 28th of 2002, and the headline is Bankers Accused of Dirty Tricks in Argentina. And we will deal with this whole article at some point in the future, but skipping down into the article, Carlos Menem is also facing a judicial investigation based on accusations made by Carrió. Carrió is an Argentine reformer, Elisa Carrió, who has been leading investigations into some of the corruption in Argentina. Beginning again, Menem is also facing a judicial investigation based on accusations made by Carrió that 80% of the money which put him in the presidency was from Gayit Faron, the Saudi billionaire and one-time partner of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, the Arab bank which was engulfed in scandals and lawsuits in 1991. BCCI has since been identified by the U.S. Senate Banking Committee as having been an important link in the financing network of Osama bin Laden. The link to Faron and BCCI will be another embarrassment for the Bushes. BCCI had many close links to the Bush family. As the Wall Street Journal has noted, there are, quote, numerous links among Harkin, a Texan energy company of which Bush Jr. was a director and major shareholder, and individuals close to the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, unquote. The links of various Bush government officials and family members to the emerging scandal in Argentina are potentially more embarrassing than the links of the present Bush government to the Enron affair. So again, note this allegation that Carlos Menem, again very close to the Bushes, was financed by the BCCI. And with the Monzarel Cassara / Yabrood Syria links and many of the other scandals that we've taken a look at in connection with Menem and the AMIA bombing, that is a very, very, very interesting connection indeed. And again, recall that the FBI investigators who looked into the AMIA bombing found that some of the Argentine policemen who were apparently involved at the operational level of that crime were members of White Aryan Resistance, an American white supremacist group linked to the milieu of Timothy McVeigh. And recall that the AMIA bombing also apparently involved, down in the Three Corners area of Latin America, collaboration between Shia terrorists associated with Hezbollah and the deadly Ahmad Mugniyah, and also Sunni terrorists associated with the Al-Qaeda milieu as well. Again, for the record, 457, among other broadcasts, goes into that. Speaking of Oklahoma City, another bit of evidence has cropped up the past week. New York Times had the following story from April 2, 2005. An AP story, Dateline Washington, new evidence found in Oklahoma City bombing. It reads in part, pursuing a tip that they missed evidence a decade ago, FBI agents searched the former home of the Oklahoma City bombing conspirator Terry L. Nichols and found explosive materials apparently related to the 1995 attack, officials said on Friday. Well, one of the things that we've looked at in many broadcasts dealing with September 11th concerns very significant evidentiary tributaries connecting A, the first World Trade Center attack in 1993 to the Oklahoma City bombing, and in turn evidentiary tributaries linking that to those crimes to September 11th and to, obviously, as we've just looked at, AMIA, or the AMIA bombing in 1994 as well. One of the things to bear in mind, again, is that there is substantive evidence that Terry Nichols in the Philippines met with Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind of the first World Trade Center attack, and that there was discussion of attacking the Oklahoma City Federal Bank, Federal Building at that particular meeting. That meeting also hatched the Operation Bojinka plan for hijacking a number of American airliners over the Pacific simultaneously and crashing them. I would also note, too, that in numerous broadcasts, including for the record 443 and 456, we took a look at what an author called the Terror Motel. This was a motel outside of Oklahoma City at which Timothy McVeigh had been seen with various unnamed Middle Eastern associates. Those Middle Eastern associates seem to have disappeared from the public view. That same motel also had an associate of Zaharias Moussaoui present at it in the run-up to the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. I would also note that that same motel, according to the manager, had been the site of a rendezvous between Mohammed Atta and Zaharias Moussaoui and others of the September 11th hijackers in the run-up to September 11th as well. Recall that among the interesting evidentiary tributaries linking neo-Nazi elements to Islamists concerns the head of the National Alliance, the late William Pierce, who in 1998 gave a broadcast and called Stay Out of Tall Buildings, in which he warned that Osama bin Laden is coming, that the U.S. would be hit with biological warfare, and that residents of New York City living or working in buildings the size of the World Trade Center should consider wearing hard hats. I don't know what the legal definition of foreknowledge is, but that comes pretty bloody close to foreknowledge of September 11th. Recall that William Pierce is the author not only of Serpent's Walk that we've spoken about, but also the Turner Diaries. The climactic episode in the Turner Diaries is a low-level suicide aerial attack against the Pentagon. Of course, that's just a novel, and we know things like that don't happen in real life. Right, boys and girls? In connection with the Oklahoma City bombing, recall also that according to Carol Howe, an ATF infiltrator who passed a lie detector test, Timothy McVeigh, in his operations at Oklahoma City, was basically acting as a protege of Andreas Strassmeyer. Andreas Strassmeyer is a former German army officer with intelligence training. Strassmeyer was also the son of Gunter Strassmeyer, Helmut Kohl's chief of staff, and Gunter Strassmeyer was the architect of German reunification. Gunter Strassmeyer's father had been one of the earliest members, one of the charter members of the Nazi Party in Germany under Adolf Hitler. And recall that in For the Record program number 456, among other broadcasts, We took a look at Andreas Strassmeyer's attempts at procuring a Boeing 747 from Lufthansa. One wonders just exactly what he was going to do with a Boeing 747 if one were smuggling contraband, either people or weapons or drugs or whatever. You wouldn't necessarily want to do that with a Boeing 747. Not only is that a very difficult plane to hide, but it can only land at certain types of airports, a smaller aircraft capable of flying low and evading radar and landing at a more remote place would seem to be a better choice. If, on the other hand, you wanted to crash a jet airliner into a building, say the World Trade Center, a Boeing 747 would be an excellent choice. So again, the evidentiary tributaries running between September 11th, the Oklahoma City bombing, the AMIA bombing, and the first World Trade Center attack are of paramount importance. They are indications of an operational link between so-called neo-Nazi elements and Islamists. Recall that one of the principals in Bank Al-Taqwa, one of its directors, is Ahmed Huber, who specifically had been working at coordinating Islamist activities with white supremacists and neo-Nazis in both Europe and the United States. Recall also that Ahmed Huber was very close to the NPD, the top German neo-Nazi party, and in turn the NPD has very close connections with the National Alliance, headed up originally and founded by the late William Pierce, the guy who forecast the World Trade Center attack in 1998. So again, when we examine the Oklahoma City bombing, it's very important to remember that not everything that we need to know has been brought forward. One thing I have not covered, I will note in passing, and perhaps I'll have time to fit this into the description of the broadcast, is that in the run-up to Terry Nichols' trial last year, actually that might have been in 2003, basically it was disclosed that a video had revealed that Timothy McVeigh had been with a number of different people, that there were far more people involved in Oklahoma City than just Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. And indeed, I think a full examination of that crime would reveal an underground Reich operational milieu involving the synthesis of neo-Nazi and white supremacist elements with Islamists, exactly what Ahmed Huber, by the way, was working to develop. And in Huber, we have a link between the fascism's past and its present and perhaps its future. Huber, a protege of Omar Amin von Leers, nay, Johann von Leers, in charge of anti-Semitic propaganda for Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry in World War II, and a primary post-World War II operative in the Nazi underground. And also, Ahmed Huber was a protege of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, an SS major, a guy who recruited personnel for three Balkan Muslim Waffen SS divisions, and an individual whose nephew and protege was none other than the late Yasser Arafat. The Grand Mufti's escape from Jerusalem was effected, according to the Asia Times, by Youssef Nada, himself a former Abwehr agent of German military intelligence, and the founder of Bank al-Taqwa, one of the principal repositories for al-Qaeda funds. In the context of the white supremacist slash Islamist link, note the following. Research credit on this also goes to a member of the listening audience. This is a story by Henry Schuster of CNN, dated Tuesday, March 29th of 2005. It's titled, An Unholy Alliance, Aryan Nation Leader Reaches Out to Al-Qaeda. And this concerns Aryan Nation's leader August Kreis's discussion of the need for reaching out to Al-Qaeda. It reads in part, at Dateline Sebring, Florida, by the way, a couple of hours up the road from where September 11th hijackers learned to fly, the new head of Aryan Nation is praising them and trying to create an alliance between his white supremacist group and Al-Qaeda. You say they're terrorists, I say they're freedom fighters. And I want to instill the same jihadic feeling in our people's heart in the Aryan race that they have for their father, whom they call Allah. With his long beard and potbelly, August Kreis looks more like a washed-up member of ZZ Top than an aspiring revolutionary. But don't let appearances fool you. His resume includes stops at some of America's nastiest extremist groups, Posse Comitatus, the Ku Klux Klan, and Aryan Nation. I don't believe that they're the ones that attacked us, Kreis said, and even if they did, even if you say they did, I don't care, unquote. Kreis wants to make common cause with Al-Qaeda because he says they share the same enemies, Jews and the American government. The terms they use may be different, White supremacists call them the Zionist occupation government, while Al-Qaeda calls them Jews and Crusaders, but the hatred is the same, and Christ wants to exploit that. Skipping down, 3 years ago I met a Swiss Islamic convert named Ahmed Huber, who began his life as a devotee of Adolf Hitler and moved on to praising former Iranian leader Ayatollah Khomeini, who led that nation's Islamic revolution and vigorously opposed U.S. policies. Huber wanted to forge a fresh alliance between Islamic radicals and neo-Nazis in Europe and the United States, and he cannot be simply dismissed as a crackpot. Huber served on the board of directors of a Swiss bank and holding company that President Bush accused of helping to fund Al-Qaeda. Recall that in For the Records 456 and 457, we took a look at an article from the December 2002 issue of Vanity Fair, that article authored by the respected Sebastian Junger, and one of the things he talks about there is an allegation, a very credible allegation from elements of Argentine intelligence, that a former Green Beret and Vietnam veteran working with the Aryan Nation, in fact, was helping to train Al-Qaeda operatives in the Three Corners area of Latin America, and that same ex-Green Beret, Aryan Nations associate, and Vietnam veteran had provided logistical assistance to Mohammed Atta on September 11th. So again, I think it's unfortunate that the tunnel vision that afflicts Mark Potok and the Southern Poverty Law Center is in fact in place, because in fact there are disturbing indications that just such a liaison not only has taken place, but that it figures in the incidents that I've already named. One of the things that scares the bejesus out of me is the following. In a number of broadcasts in the run-up to September 11th, I voiced my fear that, in fact, Al-Qaeda and the links between Al-Qaeda and George Bush were being deliberately protected by the subversion of certain investigations. Specifically, I noted the subversion of the late John O'Neill's investigation into the Kohl bombing in Kuwait, the bombing of the USS Cole. And I also noted that there were indications of subversion of John O'Neill's investigation into Al-Qaeda. After his death at the World Trade Center on September 11th, it came out that he himself was convinced that powerful American corporations, petroleum corporations in particular, were actively subverting his investigation in order to protect Saudi involvement with Al-Qaeda. I'm going to repeat a short section of an article that I've already looked at. We've looked at in For the Record 474 and in 492, and I am afraid that the same type of a pattern that we saw with John O'Neill and other FBI whistleblowers has been applied to a former FBI special agent named Mike German. Listen to the following. As a veteran agent chasing homegrown terrorist suspects for the FBI, Mike German always had a knack for worming his way into places few other agents could go. And it goes basically skipping down. So in early 2002, when Mr. German got word that a group of Americans might be plotting support for an overseas Islamic terrorist group, he proposed to his bosses what he thought was an obvious plan: go undercover and infiltrate the group. But Mr. German says FBI officials sat on his request, botched the investigation, falsified documents to discredit their own sources, then froze him out and made him a pariah. He left the Bureau in mid-June after 16 years and is now going public for the first time, the latest in a string of FBI whistleblowers who claim they were retaliated against after voicing concerns about how management problems had impeded terrorism investigations since the September 11th attacks. What I wonder is whether the next incident is in fact being planned, whether it will involve an increased use of white supremacist elements at the operational level, and whether attempts at interdicting this is being actively covered up. Recall in numerous broadcasts I have voiced my considered opinion that the current director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, is basically a ringer, and that he has delivered the Bureau to the September 11th conspirators. Who knows whether perhaps he's doing the same thing for another incident in the works, one that will involve white supremacists. We're going to wrap things up on sort of a strange note. There, there's been a major media football lately about Ward Churchill, a professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Churchill, allegedly a Native American, some Native Americans dispute his ancestry. Churchill garnered a lot of publicity by characterizing some of the victims of the World Trade Center attack on September 11th as little Eichmanns, and this has spurred calls for his resignation. He has attempted to cloak himself with the mantle of a martyr on behalf of academic freedom to the far right. One of the questions I have is whether perhaps he might actually be an agent provocateur, whether he's actually a martyr, or whether, in fact, he is acting undercover to precipitate the very things he pretends to be opposed to, is one of the questions that is raised by some aspects of his background. Not only did Ward Churchill voice support for the Contras in the 1980s, specifically because of the Sandinistas' alleged repression of the Mosquito Indians, but Ward Churchill has an interesting background, including having worked for Soldier of Fortune magazine. That magazine is published by the very formidable Robert K. Brown, an individual with very strong connections to the U.S. intelligence establishment, as well as to the mercenary milieu. We're going to read a little bit about Ward Churchill and ask, is he really a martyr, or is he deliberately trying to precipitate this kind of thing? The following article is by Thomas Brown, an assistant professor of sociology at Lamar University. It's called, Is Ward Churchill the New Michael Belisles? And skipping down, fringe speculations aside, Churchill's closet does contain a redoubtable collection of verifiable peccadillos. While employed, and it goes on to talk about alleged threats that he had made to various colleagues, threatening them with physical harm, and various other things, Churchill carried this tradition of epistolary valor over into his civilian career. He apprenticed at Soldier of Fortune magazine in the 1970s before moving into the academy. In 1998, Churchill published Pacifism as Pathology, a manifesto justifying the use of political violence. Churchill claims to have taught bomb-making to the Weather Underground. Churchill called for breaking the kneecaps of tourists headed for Hawaii as a political statement in support of Hawaiian nationalism. He repeatedly called for the destruction of the United States. And Churchill gave speeches in which he offered justifications and explicit strategies for successful terrorist actions against the U.S. And again, colleagues have disputed his Native American credentials and alleged that he made violent threats against them. Again, a lot of questions suggest themselves about Ward Churchill. Is he a martyr, or is he in fact an agent provocateur? We shall perhaps see. The various programs and lectures I've done over the years are stocked by Spitfire, CD duplication service, reached by regular mail at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Reach them by email at spitfirelist@hotmail.com. Spitfire website features the last several recorded For the Record segments available on MP3 and Real Audio, as well as long written article-length descriptions of the various For the Record shows and descriptions of other programs as well. There's a search function on the Spitfire website. The book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile is available on both HTML and Adobe PDF. Links to a website maintained by listeners in the Midwest that have the declassified U.S. government documents about the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry. And there are also links to two websites maintained by the heroic sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, that feature the entire For the Record series available for download. More recent programs are streaming on Real Audio and MP3 at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available for download only at a longer address, linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. And, by the way, WFMU is now podcasting the For the Record shows. If you'd like them downloaded to your iPod or computer, you can do just that. Contact WFMU. For the Record section, the Spitfire website, I should say, also contains a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. And if the things I talk about disturb you, there's no better way of doing something about it than supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes For the Record program number 505, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates, being recorded on April 3rd of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.